Okay, everyone, today we begin a new essay, a new ma'amar of the Kuzari. How exciting is that? Okay, we're on page 141. And in this essay, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi introduces the essay as the next chapter, not only in his book, but also in the life of the Khazar king, of this King Bulan, who has had this dream. Because apparently, after the arguments of the first essay, the king has been convinced to convert to Judaism. And this is just a small narrative where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi steps out of character. He's no longer the protagonist of the rabbi, but he's actually providing a third-person narrative of this is what happened next in the story. So I just want to ask if we can get a reader for today to start on page 141 and read the narrative. Can we get a volunteer? Anyone? Okay, Rachel, give it a shot. Just do it loud so that the camera picks it.
What happened to the Khazar king afterwards? He recorded in the Khazar history book. The book says that the king eventually revealed his recurring dream to his chief officer.
Okay, what was the recurring dream? Does anyone remember what the recurring dream was? That was at the very beginning of the first Ma'amar, the first essay.
Your intentions are good, but your deeds are not.
Your intentions are desirable, but your deeds are not. So this is the angel. So even though the king is really convinced, not by the dream, but rather by the rabbi's arguments, the impetus to spur the king into choosing one of the religions that was disputing in front of him was really, after all, the dream. And the dream, of course, is an angel. The angel, of course, comes from heaven. So that is the most convincing evidence that I can present to the other people that I want to influence that I'm the real deal and that we have to make a change. So he's trying now to convince the rest of the people in his kingdom that Judaism is not just for me, but it's for all the people. Let's continue, please.
The recurring dream told the king to go to the Warsaw Mountains and seek out the activity desired by God.
Okay, so where are these Warsaw Mountains? It takes a little bit of historical analysis, but if you want to go to the map that's at the beginning of the book, you can take a look. In the map that we have at the beginning of the book, we have a little diagram where we filled in where we believe the Warsaw Mountains are. It's a certain mountain range by the city of Derbent. It's on page 32. It's right off the coast of the Caspian Sea. So it's in the southeastern tip of the ancient kingdom of Khazaria, if you can see that. Now, where the king knows this from, it's really not clear to me. But we'll take his word from the fact that he has a document of the Chizdai letters. If you remember, we learned about these Chizdai letters a long time ago. But if you want to review the Chizdai letters, which is the historical document that forms the basis of this history of the Khazars, you can look at the appendix in the back of the book, in Appendix E. You can do that on your own time, and you can review the history of the Khazars. At one point, the king, who was corresponding with Chazdai ibn Shaprut about the history of the Khazars, tells ibn Shaprut that our king hid out in the mountains, and that's how he found his religion. And these are the Warsaw Mountains, and who knows what's going on there today. There's probably Russian tanks trying to invade Derbent or something like that. Okay, but let us continue.
The king and his chief.
So it says they're in the desert by the sea. It's by the Caspian Sea.
Should I continue?
Yes, please.
The king and his chief officer went to these mountains, which were in the desert by the sea. The books recount how, in the middle of the night, they reached the cave where Jews used to observe the Sabbath every week, and how they revealed themselves to the Jews and converted to Judaism, which includes being circumcised in that very cave. They returned to their country with their hearts committed to Judaism, but they initially hid their faith. Then, with care and discretion, they slowly began to divulge their secrets little by little to the select group of their inner circles. Their numbers grew until finally they revealed their secrets to the public and prevailed upon the rest of the Khazar population to convert to Judaism. They brought in Jewish sages and books and from different countries and learned the Torah from them.
Okay, so you notice how the king, first of all, talks about Jews who were hiding in caves. Some were in the Khazar kingdom. Now, when Jews hide in caves, this usually is a sign of religious persecution. And this is documented in many texts in the Gemara, in the Talmud, that it talks about Jews hiding in caves. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai hid in a cave when he was being persecuted. There were many stories about Jews hiding in caves in order to be able to express themselves religiously, especially on the Sabbath. So this indicates to us that perhaps even in the Khazar kingdom, which was a pagan area, Jews were a persecuted class, and the king, having this dream, realizes that he's now got to take this persecuted class and make them an elevated class within his kingdom. And so how does he do that? He takes a small delegation to hide out in one of these caves over Shabbos and to be able to, in some way, spend time with these persecuted Jews, to learn from them, to appease them, and eventually the assumption is that when the king finally reveals to his smaller enclave, which gets larger and larger little by little, eventually these Jews will cease to be a persecuted class within the Khazar kingdom. We really don't know anymore because we don't have any documentation about the Khazar Jewish community before the Khazars converted to Judaism. Okay? Now, I want to point out that there's a certain literary irony here. And as I've told you all along, the only benefit that you have of studying the Khuzari with me is that I've read the book from beginning to end. That's the only benefit that you have. So, that I would have over anyone else that's studying this book with you. I just want to point out to you that when we talk about the way that the Jewish faith grows and develops within the Khazar kingdom, it is almost precisely the very same description of how the rabbi describes how man-made religion develops and grows. Now, we studied this together, but it's a long time ago, so I want you to go back to the first essay in paragraph 80, and you can find that on page 92 in your books, in the Feldheim edition. So if I can just ask you to go back to page 92 for just a minute. We're now on page 142. Just go back to page 92. If you look on the bottom of the page in paragraph 80, the Khuzari says, let's go back to the subject. Tell me, how did your religion originate and spread? How did it eventually become universally accepted, even by those who initially disagreed with it? How long did it take your faith to take root, grow, and become completely strengthened? There must have been some evolutionary process, for all faiths undoubtedly begin with a few individuals who fortify themselves so that they can disseminate that which God wants them to. They then gradually grow in number, either because of their own might or because a ruler helps them, by forcing the masses to convert to their religion. Now, doesn't that sound almost prophetic? In the way that the king is asking this question about how did Judaism begin? It must have been this way, because if you want to spread a religion and that you want to be able to persuade people to adopt a new religion, you got to start small and you got to grow, and little by little you get people to, you know, and this is the way Christianity got started through the apostles, and this is the way Islam gets started through Muhammad and his early disciples. and it grows and grows and grows, and eventually people take over. Or you have to use some kind of physical force in order to subvert the people and force them into accepting your religion by your very, very powerful ruler. But listen to what the rabbi responds to him. He says in paragraph 81, the rabbi responded, only rational religions that have originated from human sources evolve this way. Then, when this type of religion succeeds, the founder will say that he was aided and taught by the Creator and the like. On the other hand, a religion that actually originates from the Creator will arise instantaneously. God just says, let it be, and it will be, just like the creation of the universe. So when we're talking about the formation of Judaism, what was that moment of instantaneous sprouting of religion? What was that moment? What moment is he referring to? How Judaism... What's that? Matan Torah? Yeah, Har Sinai. All of a sudden, the Jews are gathered around the mountain, and all of a sudden, they hear the voice of God. That's it. Religion, Judaism, has now started. There's no evolutionary process. There's no one person talking to another person, having them over for coffee and telling them about the ways of God and being persuasive and showing intellectually why it makes sense and why emotionally it makes sense. None of that stuff. There's no denying your own experience, and that's how Judaism gets started. And that's what makes it so powerful, and that's what makes it, as remember from Rabbi Yehuda Levi's arguments in the first essay, that's what makes it superior as far as its acceptability as a religion to all other faiths. Now look at the irony that in describing how the Jewish faith takes hold within the Khazar kingdom sometime in the 8th or 9th centuries, according to Reb Yehuda Halevi's narrative, it takes hold not through Maimud Har Sinai, right, but through the very same evolutionary process which Reb Yehuda Halevi was critical of in describing the other religions other than Judaism. So what do you think? I'm just asking you if you could think for a second. And notice he says, then with care and discretion, they slowly began to divulge their secret, little by little, to a select group of their inner circle. Their numbers grew until finally they revealed their secret to the public and prevailed upon the rest of the Khazar population to convert to Judaism. They brought in Jewish sages and books from different countries and learned the Torah from them. So do you see the irony here? Do you see that he's describing an evolutionary process which he was originally critical of when talking about other religions? So is this just a coincidence? Or do you think that he's trying to convey some kind of message to us? And if there is a message, what do you think Reb Yehuda Halevi is trying to convey?
Well, there's a difference between revelation to a person and conversion of people who weren't there. Or if they were there, I know there are some who say that everyone who eventually converts was there.
Was there, yeah. Yeah.
But, if you didn't know you were there, or you didn't, if you do convert, it's a different, completely different process from either being born into a faith or
yes,
having it revealed to you.
Yes, very good, very good. So perhaps he is creating a contrast between the Khazar nation of converts and the Jewish people. We know that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi himself does draw a very strong ontological line of distinction between a natural-born Jew and a convert. We know that. He's unique in that position, and he's very controversial. He's been criticized for that position that he took, that converts to Judaism are part of the Jewish people, but they lack that special quality that allows them to achieve prophecy. And perhaps he's alluding to that in this paragraph as well, that, you know, this is the process that a convert has to go through, and it lacks that special quality of transmission from parent to child that people that were at Har Sinai and or their parents were or grandparents were able to achieve. That's very possible. I didn't think of that. I also thought in a related way that maybe he's sort of foreshadowing, since Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is living during a time when the Khazars are experiencing a very significant decline. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is writing this in the 12th century when the Khazars are sort of now fading from world history. Maybe he's, and certainly they're declining in their Jewish faith. Perhaps he's offering an explanation as to why that decline took place, because maybe it never really took hold in the way that Judaism took hold for the rest of the Jewish people, which is, with the exception of individual converts who become part of the Jewish nation, this is a unique experiment in Jewish history where an entire nation of people converts to Judaism. And because, perforce, that experience of national conversion was done through this kind of method, it didn't stick. It didn't stick. That's also a possibility. Any other things that you can think of? I mean, yes, please.
I have a question. I mean, even though Judaism technically in Har Sinai, they all converted, in a way they did start from an individual Abraham, and the Jewish people were his children and his descendants, and they had certain values that were transmitted to him. They weren't the whole Torah, but yet monotheistic values. They didn't just show up in Har Sinai arbitrarily. I mean, there was something
that's true.
Going on there.
That's way. True. And that's a very good point. But there's a big difference between a religion that is comprised of very specific laws and a value system. A value system is something that can be transmitted through an evolutionary process. But a revelatory religious system that requires a very strict method of adherence to a very specific and demanding set of laws is not something that can easily be transmitted and can evolve in this way. I think that would be the distinction to draw. I was also thinking, that any other religion other than the religion of Maimon Har Sinai has to start this way. And he's just basically suggesting that the Khazars were no exception. Whether or not he's trying to allude to the decline of the Khazars is not clear to me. But I just thought that there was such a stark and comparison between these two passages that I don't think that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was just writing this by chance. I think that he was trying to clue us into something. Okay, let us go one more paragraph, maybe one or two more paragraphs. Please go ahead, Rachel.
The Khazar books detail all their successes in vanquishing their enemies, conquering various lands, discovering hidden treasures, and amassing armies.
Numbering,
in the hundreds of thousands. They also elaborate on how the Khazars loved the Torah and yearned for the temple to the point where they erected a facsimile of the tabernacle that Moshe built. They gave honor to their local Jews and took pride in them.
Right, so where we get this idea that all of these wars that they fought and the hidden treasures and that they built a facsimile of the Mishkan, these are all things that you'd have to go back into the Khazar correspondences that were part of the Chazdai letters and see where you can find that. That's all in Appendix E. Remember, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is really hearing this as he's getting this from all secondhand. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi never went to Khazaria. I'm sure he never met a Khazar Jew in his life. But he's getting this all from the Chazdai letters which are written in the back of your book. You can read them. They gave honor to their local Jews and took pride in them, right? So it's like the Jews are the Kohanic tribe. They're like the privileged class in the Khazar kingdom. So, I mean, think about if you were a Jew living in Khazaria, what kind of life experience that would be for you. You'd be exalted as one of the chosen people, you know, which something to look forward to when Mashiach comes, I guess, right? Okay, so let's go to the third paragraph.
When the king studied the Torah and the prophets, he took the rabbi as his teacher and asked him questions regarding the Hebrew text. He first asked him about the names and the attributes which are ascribed to the blessed Creator, since a number of these attributes imply some level of physicality, whereas physicality is precluded both intellectually and explicitly by the Torah.
Okay. So first of all, we see that King Bulan, who's now a devout Jew, says, I need a Rebbe. So he hires the rabbi who was brought in for the disputation and really was the protagonist throughout the first essay. He's now an employee of the king, and he's going to continue the education process from essays 2 through 5 in educating the king further about Judaism. But it's not just that the rabbi's going to teach him about halacha, hilchas Shabbos, and hilchas mezuzah, and hilchas kashrus, and those other things. They're going to continue this disputation between each other about certain things that are still troubling the king about Judaism. And one of the things is that now that I'm studying more and more Chumash, I'm beginning to realize that there are certain texts that, when taken at face value, are somewhat problematic. Because we see that Hashem is described in the Tanakh sometimes in anthropomorphic terms, that they describe some level of physical quality to God. And we know both intellectually and scripturally that that's impossible. Now that statement, that last statement that he makes, is something that I'd like to build on next week, because it's not such a simple thing. And we have to figure out where he gets this idea. So we'll save that for next time. But I just want to point out that the rabbi in this story is described in this narrative as now becoming under the employ of the king. You'll note that I know something that's going to happen later on in the book. At the very end of the book, the very end of the fifth essay, the king turns to turns to the king, and he says, I've really enjoyed being your teacher, but now it's time for me to go. And this might have taken a year, it might have taken 10 years, we don't know how long this period of time is. But he says, it's time for me to go and to make Aliyah. And there's a whole big fight that breaks out at the end of this book between the king, who says, why are you leaving me? Stay, you can do everything you need to do in Khazaria. And the rabbi, who says, I don't think you've been listening to me, I've been trying to explain to you that a Jew can only find perfection in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, I've reached all I can reach in this life, outside in Chutz La'aretz, and I need to now take my leave. So we're getting now a foreshadowing of this narrative. This is a long saga, but the part of the story that we're hearing now is that the rabbi is making a life for himself in Khazaria for some extended period of time, but just realize that eventually he's going to pack up and leave when he feels he's given the king as much as he can about Judaism. So we will get there. This is where I wanted to hold it for today, and we'll continue this. We'll continue the disputation and the conversation, Mirtz Hashem, next time. Okay. Yes, please.
This is just a side, but yesterday morning when I was reading the Times of Israel and computer,
yes,
I didn't have time to read the whole story, but there was a headline saying that genetic studies that have recently been done found no Khazar genes in Ashkenazi Jews.
Yeah. That's the latest study.
Yeah, and it's important because that's one of the claims that Palestinians have, that Netanyahu et al. Are not really Jewish.
Yes, I'm glad that you raised that. I just want to, when I go lecturing in different communities about the Khazari, one of my lectures is about who are the Khazars today and who are Ashkenazi Jews today. And so the debate really started, in the 70s with the publishing of a book called The 13th Tribe by Arthur Kessler, who, based on earlier scholarship, had theorized that most Ashkenazi Jews are really not from the 12 tribes of Israel, but are rather from the Khazars, because we don't know what happened to the Khazars. That one's my copy. Oh, is this? Wait a minute. Oh, here you go. Sorry.
You're gonna ruin the inside.
But yeah, so that's something that has been going back and forth. And there was about 5 years ago, there was another book that was published by a professor at Tel Aviv University called Shlomo San, who published a book also trying to argue for Kessler's side that Jews are descended, Ashkenazi Jews are primarily descended from Khazars. But the latest genetic studies are really pretty much refuting that. But I'll bet you a donut that someone else is going to come out with a study within 5 years showing the other side. Yeah, because genetics is not a perfect science yet. Okay.